point.
No, I think really the point was that we're required to expand more, which we, as I say, we got these young and excellent dealers coming in, which made it much easier. And by then, capital was being built up. And on capital, before I go into more detail, I think one should, I'm sure that all jobbers would pay mark of appreciation for the help that they receive from the banks. If you had a good reputation as such, and you suddenly had a particularly big deal on, and you went to the bank and said, "Right, this is a one-off deal," and you, I don't know whether you know about you want borrowed from the banks by taking up stock in their name so that they had the security, and they would check the valuation and so on. If you went up and you said, "Well, this is a one-off one," we're not sort of immediately doubling the size of our well, markets or anything, but we bought this chunk of stock which we want to finance until we sell it, which hopefully will be the next account or something. They were always very helpful and very understanding. And we banked from the very early days from the old National Bank, which was an Irish bank, and changed various shapes and sizes until it ended up as the Royal Bank of Scotland. And I would say they were absolutely first class.
And the bank's your main source of finance when you required it.
In those days, because the idea of stock borrowing didn't exist then, which was again, of course, was a tremendous advantage to the system, not only to the jobbers, the thing being that if you were a bearer of stock, there was nothing you could do about it, you'd sold it. But if you could borrow it, you could then deliver it on and get the money, and the firm lending the stock, of course, got a rate of interest. So it was really beneficial to, very beneficial to the system, really, and made it more liquid, of course.
Did the firm itself expand during the post-war period, or were you still more or less the
In the
same size?
First War, I would have thought during the war, it was a much smaller firm, and I would have thought it was fairly similar to the last war because a number of the people in it certainly went to 1418 war. And let's say Harry Bishop was in that one and in the second one. It began to pick up from then. As I say, I went there in 1933, well, 1931, which I think was the last uncle who had left. We dealt in a lot more stocks, but I remember that taking them over, they were almost standing at nothing in there. They're quite good companies in that slump, so it must have been fairly terrifying then. But 33 onwards, of course, it began to pick up until, I suppose, running up towards the war period, there was an increasing turnover. And the country as such was emerging from the slump. Then there was, oddly enough, the car companies benefited from the start of rearmament because they were brought in to make either engines or spare parts and bits and pieces, so that was helped them.
So in the post-war period, did you try and expand as business expanded?
Yes, well, we began to expand in size of business, and as I say, we took on a shipping book, and there were, of course, also was quite a lot of new issues coming, and later on, this is jumping right ahead to the 80s, but, Brian Winterflood made a specialist market in the USMs, which he'd handled sort of brilliantly, and which was a very useful profit maker.
Yes, USMs being unlisted securities.
Unlisted securities market, which was then in its infancy. So we expanded quite a bit, and we did take on more stocks as they came along. It was always a great difficulty in going into new markets. We did go into the brewery market, which had been a very tightly knit between two big jobbers in the past. And that we were was sort of a very small part, but it was one that could have been developed later. So that it, let's say, if you were going to take there was a certain amount, well, more than a certain amount, there was quite a lot of competition and objection for jobbers going outside their previous stocks or previous sectors. And if you just took up a stock in a sector because it was profitable, then that was, I think, correctly frowned on. If, on the other hand, you wanted to take up a sector, stores or something like that, the jobbers didn't want you to do it, the brokers might, but very often if they got you to take up a single stock, it was merely because they'd had a row with some other jobber, and you got a lot of stick from the other jobbers and not very much benefit yourself, so one didn't. Where you had a stock in your market took over another stock or vice versa, it's quite acceptable that you, acceptable is not the word, accepted, that it was accepted that you should deal in both until such time as the deal had either failed or completed. Yes. And then if yours was the stock was taken over, you didn't take up the bidder, whereas if yours was the bidder, you continued to deal and the other chap didn't take up that stock. But there were, you know, always sort of marginal cases and jobbers storming up. So I hear you were dealing in so-and-so, one of my stocks. Well, I'm going to deal in. He'd look at the board and say, that and that of yours.
Were you generally on amicable terms with other jobbing firms?
I think so. I think I would describe it best as really, if you think in terms of the opposition in the House of Commons, they put out the most sort of appalling attacks on one another there, and suggestions of the faults and so on and so forth. Outside, they're really quite amicable, and I think it's very much the same with the jobbing system. On the whole, I think because the system was so important that bad blood didn't really break up so much among the top people. Usually where it got involved was two firms, the two go-ahead dealers, decide, you know, taking one another on, both wanted to show they were best. And this could, you know, sort of really get quite out of hand. And then if it wasn't stopped fairly early on, then it would go up to the top. And then the head partners would start getting involved. I was an honorary market official. So if you'd like to sort of make a note of that I can give you a bit of example of that later on. Although that most of those cases were really between brokers and jobbers rather than, although occasionally it was between two brokers and occasionally it was between two jobbers.
And so how could you contrast your relations with jobbers with your relations with brokers?
Well, I think that obviously you wanted to get on with brokers, to be friendly and to help them and for them to help you. Jobbers you regarded, I think, as a necessary evil. If you only had one jobber in the stock, brokers didn't like it very much to the degree that they felt that they were always at your mercy. And although I think, on the whole, if you happened to be the one chap in the stock, you didn't try and rip people off because you knew if you rip them off, they'd go along to another jobber and say, well, look, I do a lot of business in this and I've only got so-and-so dealing. Would you like to start up and, you know, we can put some business your way? So if you were the one jobber, you were fairly careful. And later on, when the jobbing system was being looked at again, we began to go through stocks. And if there was job with one stock and somebody else would take it on, which became quite acceptable. So I think you regarded them as necessary evils. There was a certain amount of goodwill between them, but not always.
As we go through now the 60s, 70s, right up to the point where you retire, was the firm steadily increasing in size? Did you ever
move? I think, yes, it was increasing in size because we were doing more business, and there was quite a lot of business. And we were producing our own capital as well as sort of having the assistance of the banks. And then, of course, there came the time when the stock exchange saw the problem and realised that for these elderly partners wanting to get out in particular with their money, because I think the attraction was for the older partners that their capital ranked, the interest on that capital ranked as earned income. So although they mightn't be making particularly any money themselves, while they were there and they could see how it was going, it was a very good investment for them. But I would certainly understand once they were going, they would want to take their money with them and not leave it to somebody else to play around with. So the stock exchange didn't get that. We didn't have to become remain as partnerships because the taxation would be able to come as unlimited liability companies, that is, to come under the company tax status, but still to have individual responsibility for the firm and to stock exchange for what you did and so on. So very roughly over 5 years you probably had two normal years, one very good one, one very rough one, and one adequate plus. And if you in that 5 year span you weren't making a reasonable average and something was wrong, either you weren't good enough or you were in the wrong markets or you needed to change. But I think one really always in every 5 year period you had a rough passage and you had one thumping good one. The conditions were right and your books were right and everything was gelling. But of course as costs rose from the amount that you paid people, rent, stock exchange charges went mounting up. The first day of each new year, as we were saying, partners, you knew roughly what your expenses were going to be, and you had to start off to making a billion or whatever it was, and you had no idea what your profits were going to be. So you had to watch those beginning of the year very carefully, and if you weren't making any money at the start of it, it was adding on to your costs, and so see the hill getting higher and higher.
Were you involved in any merger activity? Were you taking over firms?
No, we took over the shipping one.
Which firm was that?
I thought you were going to ask me then. I'll come back to that in a moment. I was going to look it up. And there was this little Wayman and Dives, which was I'd mentioned, which we took over. The chap who was running a sort of tiny little book. So when we gave him a home, and so that gave us some of the leading industrials, the key rice, the iron, imperial tobacco, and so on. But we didn't go into the mergers. We looked at certainly the gilt market, which was interesting. It was one time the gilt market made a large amount of the money if it had gone in with an industrial one. And then, of course, the time fell, the gilt edge became less lucrative and the equity markets produced the money. So I think with Durlach, I hit it fairly right. They did it. But I think there was always a trouble, not so much among the top people who would say, right, well, this probably makes some sense. But you had to be a bit careful if it was becoming a monopoly or anything like that. That's how, when Smith approached us, we went up to, had to make our case and so on, and so forth. But the slotting in of the middle order was always fairly difficult, because one, you had to have some sort of pecking order, and wasn't an easy thing to do. And by, as I say, by the time we might have been going to do it seriously, already the market had sort of so shrunk that it was going to cause any, it was bound to cause an inquiry if we'd done it.
Now, at this time, the number of jobbing firms was contracting.
It was contracting considerably.
Now, how was this, was this affecting your work on the floor? Was jobbing changing?
Well, I mean, would you like to start taking that from the questionnaire? Where it was contraction of the number of firms, whatever number. Right. I think we'll start with the reason for the large number of firms. In the old days, when there were these lot of jobbing firms, they required very little capital, to the degree that they were small, they were not competitive to the big jobbers, and at the end of the account, they would level off their positions, unless they had a very strong feeling that they wanted to be a bull or a bear. So they would cut the liabilities at the end of the account, perhaps make a few pounds here and there, and, you know, enough to live on. Now, a lot of people thought that they were sort of real excrescence, as it were. I've always had quite a feeling that they produced a use, certainly in the gilt market, where sizable bargains are the name of the game. And you can see that to get cluttered up with a lot of small bargains every day was a nuisance to these people. I mean, in terms of turnover and profit, these sort of thousand war loan and so on and so forth were minimum. And so the Gilt Edge jobbers, the small chaps, took this business on, made a bit of profit on it, and then, as I say, closed their positions at the end of the day or end of a few days, because the guild, of course, is cash dealing and the equities were account dealing. So the small equity chaps would close at the end of the account, and so they knew exactly what they'd done. And also in those days there were a lot of small broking firms who didn't have adequate staff to cover the market. And it was, so say they had partner and got an order in, was at a gold market, where also there were small jobbers. Well, if he went on to one of the big people, he wouldn't have a clue what was going on, whether he was doing the right price or anything. Well, by going to one of these little jobbers who were actually in it, that jobber knew the touch, which is the closest price you could get by knowing all the jobbers. And he would, the broker would then, shall we say, sell him the stock at £5.05, and he would go on and sell it at £5.06 or something to a big jobber. And although he would say always giving away, you know, a bit of the client's money, he might well have been saving him money, because if the broker himself had gone in to do it, he might have been completely lost. And so I think on the whole, they were tolerated, and they were usually also quite pleasant and decent people. There was one small firm of jobbers who certainly wouldn't apply to, and of course they went out fairly shortly out of business. But what they had this sort of business, and the head partner then thought he'd start to get a bit larger, and he then began to actually sort of, as it were, impinge on the market, which was fair enough, he was any good. But also, at the end of the account, he expected to be treated as a small chap and just, you know, get out on your price. And what the real row started, as you probably know, jobbers were able to take up stock at the end of the account on the 10-bob stamp.
Can you explain that?
It became 50p later on in life. And So when brokers wanted to do cash and new, you bought the stock from them. It only cost you, because you were taking it up on your 50p or stamp. You sold it on at a price that you regarded as that you could get away with and what the broker regarded as reasonable to do. And he carried it over to the next account. In the old days, we can come back to contangos, which was used to do it. But anyway, this chap then started taking up, doing this in a much on tighter terms, getting always inside what one of the market makers would say he'd do it. So you said, okay, well, cost you fourpence halfpenny or something. He would say, whatever they tell you, I'll do it inside, you see. So he'd do it for fourpence or three farthings. And I'm not sure that he wasn't also borrowing the money on rather strange terms. That's immaterial. But anyway, they got fed up, so they said, okay, you're either a jobber or you're not. So in due course, he pulled out. But by and large, I would say that they did perform a function in those days. And like the whole thing, the stock exchange kept evolving because, as I say, there were a lot of gifted amateurs, and my counsel always take a lot of stick, as everybody does who has to make decisions which people don't like. But they were not, I don't think, the obstructive people they were supposed to be. And as when things became necessary to move, they were prepared to accept the moves and move with it. And so over a period of time, these people dropped out, or they got taken over, or they joined something else, or if they were one-man band, they'd probably made enough to retire and go out altogether.
Well, would there be people to take their place, or do you mean they'd slowly disappear?
Well, they slowly disappeared, and I mean, some of them got taken over. If I would have said that the small ones disappeared and went out, you know, when they had enough to retire on. Some of the sort of small, medium ones packed up, and perhaps one or two of the junior partners or dealers would be placed somewhere else with a jobbing firm and would be entitled to take their stocks with them. And either they would run them all, and if the firm that took them over thought, well, yes, there's a market, they could build up on it, and if they thought it wasn't worth it, they'd throw their stocks out, would put the chap onto an existing book, so he had a job.
About when would all these people have disappeared?
I suppose by the mid-50s, we were coming down to the smaller to mediums were still there, and they were then starting to get absorbed into the bigger ones. The really small ones, that, like I've explained, they were just sort of almost doing the broker's business, or if a broker had a put-through, he was friendly with one of these little chaps, he'd give him the put-through, and nobody minded very much if it was 500 shares, because it was, 120,000, then the market maker would object, because the price done was obviously on what he was making, not what the little fellow was. So I think probably by the end, in the equities, there were probably something of five medium to large firms, which we would be at the smaller end of the five.
And Bisgood Bishop was never in that category of a small jobber.
No.
And it had always acted as a market maker. Well,
it was a market maker, as I say, particularly in the in the days when it started with the, I suppose it was a bit small then, but it was small, but it was a market maker. Although we did a lot of the business, I say, undoing it with Birmingham, where there was existing market in the, because that's where the motor industry was based, and the components. And one of the things is sort of the present days with all these extraordinary regulations and so on and so forth, to supposedly to protect the small person, which of course one can have views on. But I was told my uncle, who were, as I say, although when they'd gone, they kept the name still Bisgood Bishop, because it was a good one. But brokers would go to my uncle and say, particularly the second one, Bertrand. Here's a list of the orders I've got. Would you do them for me? And knowing quite well that he would do them, if necessary, he'd say, well, this is, you know, I've done this, I've had to deal with tight on this, and I've taken a bit more on that. But they knew that he would do it, just take them in. And then, of course, we began to build it up, and after the war, and that Hattie Bishop became a partner, was a very strong, if not say aggressive, character. And then Strawn, who came from Haddo and Turner, which was a medium-sized firm in those days, one of the Island Steel people, they began, you know, sort of market making, and then Coventry and Birmingham began to come to us instead of the other way around.
So by the 50s, as you say, most of the smaller firms
were disappearing. Yes.
So that left you with a group of...
Then a group of medium size, and you know, the larger firms.
Yes. And was there a process of thinning out among that group, or did they all?
Yes, it went on yes. Thinning and merging until, as I say, in the end were the five larger firms and then some specialist firms.
Yes. What distinguished the firms that survived from the firms that didn't?
Fate and the senior partners, I suppose. As I say, our time when the bishops had a great chunk of the money, which was why they ran the thing as they wanted to. And we were just fortunate enough to be getting back into cash ourselves,
yes.
Which we'd left in the firm. You know, sort of for this time, because we intended to go on. We certainly didn't want to be taken over in those days and disappear. Mm-hmm. We're possibly always a bit slightly bloody-minded in some ways. Other people said, well, we've done jolly well. The top people will get out now with our money and do whatever we want to do. Some of them had a great sense of responsibility and wouldn't do it until they'd placed the other people. Others, there was one firm, a chap came back from holiday and went to his pitch. Jobbers always had the permanent place where they could be found, and sat down and waited for his jobbing books to come. And somebody went up and said, and sort of went by, and he thought, that's very odd. Somebody else said, what are you waiting for? He said, well, I don't know, I'm waiting for my jobbing books. He said, this is no good, the firm backed up last week.
Now, at some point, Biscuit Bishop ceased to be a partnership and became a company.
Yes.
Now, can you say a little bit about that?
Yes.
The reasons for that. When did it actually happen?
71.
Yes.
That's, well, actually, and then we became, made a placing with the three institutions for 72. I think perhaps I come on to this bit about the capital here. I'm reading now because I think this is more clearly written than I would do it. The major problems were encountered with the necessity to trade as a partnership under old stock exchange rules. All profits earned, whether drawn by partners or retained in the business, were subject to income tax, surtax, etc., at very high rates. So the building up of capital for the expansion of the business and paying out capital belonging to retiring partners, often off a substantial part of the money, was exceptionally difficult. This position was recognised by the stock exchange, and so that the firms were allowed to reconstitute as unlimited partners, which gave them corporate status for these purposes, but maintaining unlimited personal liability as directors. So instead of partners, we became directors. And then it moved forward to the limited liability companies and outside ownership. So we formed a company, created the shares in it, and then found man, first class, Slater. I don't know whether you've come across him. He was with the Williams and Glynns, as they were by that time. And we'd approached him with this, and he's one of the trustees of the Grosvenor Estate and so on, and he's chairman of various companies now. And so they brought in the Legal and General and British and Commonwealth, and they took a 10% stake each. So that's how we set it up. We had thought at one time that possibly there would be more interchange of ideas between the shareholders and the company as such as the dealings, but I think from their point of view, this was a new thing and they wanted to keep it completely separate. It was an investment, and as they might have bought Rio Tinto or BP, they bought us and they didn't want it really to go beyond that. And I think possibly we would have run under some complications if we'd been doing their dealing for them. One might cause a lot of chaos. So they were virtually separate. They came to lunch and we just...